Today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
Next week marks the centenary of the birth of the Irish author Brendan Behan, who in his short life achieved both fame and infamy on the back of his writing talents and his very public alcoholism. Now today we're going to look back on his life and legacy. Professor Dermot Ferriter, Professor of Modern History at UCD, joins me in the studio. You're very welcome. Good
morning,
to see
Claire.
You again. Brendan Behan, born in 1923, died at the young age of 41. But maybe we'll go back to the beginning. Talk to me a little bit about his early life.
He was born in Hull Street in February 1923. He was a Civil War baby. And it's important to remember that because his father was actually interned at the time that he was born. And his mother, Kathleen Behan, was from a very Republican family. She had been a courier in 1916 during the Rising in Dublin, and she was married to Jack Furlong originally, who had participated in the 1916 Rising, but he died in 1918 from influenza. So Stephen was the second husband, Brendan's father, but he was also obviously a very committed anti-treaty Republican. So he steeped from the beginning in that tradition of Dublin working class militant republicanism, and it has a profound impact on him. And he grows up initially in Russell Street in a tenement. His granny was the owner of a few tenement buildings, and she ruled the roost and also introduced him to drink at a very early age, which is important because he did say at a later stage that he never remembered a time when he wasn't drinking. And it's very sad, really, that was embedded as a habit from childhood. As he put it, you know, he didn't turn to drink. You know, the drink turned to him at a very early stage. And there was nothing funny about that. But he is also obviously a very interesting child, an inquisitive one, a performer. He also absorbs a lot of the stories of the revolutionary era and the music as well. And he's inducted into Na Fianna, the youth wing of the IRA, at a very early stage. And he graduates then up to the IRA as a teenager. And that's when he starts to get into trouble.
And does that lead him then to what happened to him in England when
it
he was first
to the Borstal,
incarcerated?
You know, and I mean, going into the Borstal in many ways was the making of Brendan Behan. He was quite lucky. He was only 16. He headed off on a solo mission. You know, typical Brendan Behan to go off on a solo mission as a 16-year-old to bomb the Liverpool docks. And he cut quite a farcical figure in relation to that. But he did end up in Borstal rather than prison because of his tender years. And it's interesting, the Home Office files on Behan's time there were only opened in the early years of this century, and they did reveal the effect of his charm. He had quite an influence on Cyril Joyce, who was the governor in Hollisey Bay, the Borstal where he was, and he encouraged him. He encouraged him because clearly there was a fiercely independent imagination and creative impulse at the heart of Behan, even at that stage. And it was recognised and it was encouraged on the grounds that this would be a step towards his rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. And he spends 3 years there, but he hasn't quite matured. And in 1941, when he returns to Dublin, he gets involved in the IRA again in a very serious episode where shots are fired at a guard. And he ends up being incarcerated. And he was lucky that he didn't get the death penalty at that stage because the state is really clamping down on the IRA at that point. But he spends time in Mountjoy and in the Curragh. And again,
I mean, that must have been a lengthy sentence, was it, Dermot?
It was a lengthy sentence. He was sentenced to 14 years. He got out in 1946. He ended up serving about five, I think. And there was an amnesty in 1946 under the Fianna Fáil government at that time. So he benefited from that. So there was a degree of luck there as well. And it was difficult, again, for him, obviously, coping with that incarceration. But also, he had at that stage elders who were encouraging him, mentors, people like Sean O'Fallon and Padraig O'Donnell, who was a veteran socialist Republican and also a writer. And again, they recognised that there was a talent there that needed to be brought to the fore. But the authorities made it quite difficult at that stage. So he wasn't able to exercise the kind of artistic liberty that he would have enjoyed.
Was he writing in the Borstal in England? Was he writing when he was in Mountjoy?
Do you know what's very interesting about The Borstal Boy? The Borstal Boy is eventually published in 1958 as a novel, and it's regarded as his masterpiece, but it's gestating from really the late 1930s into the early 1940s. Sean O'Fallon's The Bell magazine actually published a piece by Behan in 1942, which is about the beginnings of his Borstal experience. So it's obviously building from a very early stage, and it's a very long, drawn-out process, but it was worth the wait.
So released then from Mountjoy onto the Curragh, then released, what happened then? Where did he go? What
was
he doing?
That's getting serious about being a writer. You know, he has to leave that IRA stuff behind him, not necessarily his sympathies, but he wants to become a writer. Now, the class dimension is very important here. He feels the odds are stacked against him as a working class writer. And as he saw it, Irish cultural life was largely concerned at that stage with rural affairs. And as he put it, he was not interested in writing about the hungry bog or the scarcity of crumpet, as he put it. And that was a dig, perhaps, at the poetry of Patrick Kavanagh. And he said, I'm a city rat. Sean O'Casey is in Devon. James Joyce is dead. So he felt that as a representative of the Dublin working class, the odds were stacked against
him. Was he right?
In many ways, he was. He actually went to the Gaeltacht for a period and he wrote what became a very well-known poem, As Gaeilge, which is about a Dubliner lamenting the Blasket Islands. And he also demonstrated a flair for writing sensitively in the Irish language at that stage. But then he ends up in Paris. Paris is the place to go. That, of course, being such a creative hub. And he does encounter very famous writers like Camus and Sartre and, of course, Beckett, who was in Paris at that stage.
And how was he surviving?
He was surviving because he was able to make a living as a journalist. Now, it's not a very secure living, but he has already developed a particular style. He's a raconteur. He's somebody who can talk on radio and he can write. He can fire off journalistic articles, pieces. And he is using that to pay the day-to-day bills whilst creating space for himself to work. But the drinking is getting in the way even at that stage. You know, the idea is that he'd get up early in the morning and work very hard and then the pubs will open. So, you know, that's the routine that's established. But he's doing okay at that stage.
Mm-hmm. So from Paris then, I'm not sure what year he went to Paris, but 1954 was when his work first reached the stage. Is that
it
right?
It all really happens for Behan between 1954 and 1958. You know, that is the really frenetic
the golden
period.
Age.
The golden period. And of course, it's the period, golden period of a very short life. He died at the age of 41. And it's originally The Queer Fellow. And this becomes a very topical play. It's staged originally in the tiny but innovative Pike Theatre in Dublin that's run by Carolyn Swift and Alan Simpson. And it really is a small theatre, but it's daring, that theatre. And they're staging a very edgy play because this is topical. This is about the death penalty. This is about the vicissitudes of prison life for a prisoner awaiting execution. And it's about humanising that dilemma. And it's about social exclusion. And it's about poverty and all of those themes. But it's Joan Littlewood, when she gets her hands on it in London, the famed theatre director, she brings it. Of course, a huge profile and a huge fame.
From what I read, she was very influential on him and in honing what he had written.
Massively, yeah. Honing is an interesting word because some scholars would argue that she, in many respects, diluted the originals, particularly when it comes to The Hostage, which is the next big play. What was on Gael in the Irish language that was staged in Undamer. He gave it to Gail Lynn. And again, that's about him taking the business of his heritage seriously and writing the Irish language seriously. But when Joan Littlewood gets that and produces it in London, it really becomes a music hall variety show. And it's got satire and campness and risque references to topical controversies, including homosexuality. It becomes something very different. Scholars, interestingly, people like John McCourt and John Brannigan, who've written extensively on Behan in recent times, have excavated that adaptation and the extent to which it diverted so much from the mm-hmm. original work that it
but
was
then,
something
I
entirely
suppose,
different.
If she did that, she made him successful because otherwise we mightn't have heard about Brendan Behan had she not been involved and carried out
absolutely
that work.
Absolutely right. I mean, he achieved international fame and he was being interviewed. He was interviewed on the BBC, famously Malcolm Muggeridge interviewing him. He's becoming Brendan of Broth of a Boy fame. Mm-hmm. He becomes a character. He becomes a storyteller. Some would argue that he becomes a stage Irishman in that process because that's a very respected medium, television at that stage. You know, it's very conservative and he's ribald and there's a lack of reverence there and there's great wit on display a lot of the time, but there's also public drunkenness and that causes outrage and that feeds in then to the notoriety and the fame of Behan. But it also, of course, puts him on the circuit and that's a problem.
Let's. Dave Fanning was here last week talking about the Chelsea Hotel, and he mentioned his time there, Brendan Behan's time there. And I think we have a clip. This is when the hostage was brought to New York, and this is a snippet of Brendan Behan, and he was asked why there aren't many Behans in New York. And here's what he said.
I could give you three reasons for that. The reason the old lady in Aaron gave me, why there weren't many Dublin people in America, she said, they don't have the money to go there. They wouldn't work if they got there. And thirdly, she said, they wouldn't be let in.
I love hearing that accent.
Yeah.
You don't hear much of that accent anymore.
No, and I mean, Behan always remained the Dublin Behan, for all his travels. And he was on the circuit. His wife, Beatrice, who he married in 1955, referred to the carnival of that trip, the United States trip, particularly in 1960, where he was expected to travel up to 300 miles to deliver a funny speech and then the next day do it all over again, yes. 300 miles further. There was always a microphone being thrust into his face. And of course, he was very good at coming up with some witty responses. But I think that clip is interesting because he was also able to interject in making very serious points about the history of Irish immigration. And his persona internationally annoyed a lot of people at home, including Sean Lamass, who was Taoiseach in 1961 and complained very bitterly about Irish characters moving around, as he put it, in clouds of alcoholic vapour. And he was talking about the BBC broadcasting these interviews with, you know, drunken Irish characters. And himself, and indeed Eamon de Valera, thought that this was belittling Ireland's reputation and Ireland's achievement. So there were certain tensions around that.
Mm-hmm.
But Behan responded by suggesting that there wasn't enough awareness on the part of the establishment about what it was to be a working class emigrant and the difficulties that came with that. So there's quite a class tension there, I think.
The Catholic Church, John Charles McQuaid, I know he had a submission from one of his priests beseeching him to have Behan's work banned.
Yeah, and I mean, the Borstal boy was very edgy and was banned. You know, he referred to himself as being in the best band in the band in the world, you know, that list of prohibited authors. And the Borstal boy in 1958, again, was very innovative, was a very, very clever work of imagination mixed with realism and his own experiences. But there are also erotically charged passages in it and moments of great violence. And it's quite an achievement in modern literature, but Behan would have referred to himself as a daylight atheist. And, you know, again, consider the delicacy of these themes in the late 1950s and the early 1960s. And he was capable of great wit about it. I mean, it said on the day that he died in the Meath Hospital in 1964 that a nun looking after him adjusted his pillows and he turned to her and said, "Thank you, sister, and may you be the mother of a bishop." So he was capable of that irreverence there when it came to the influence of the religion. But he's also conscious of the heritage that he's carrying. And he was carrying, I think, a lot of conflicted emotions about his own feelings, about his own sexuality.
Yeah, talk to me about that. You mentioned his marriage, and I read a really sensitive note that he wrote to his wife when he was being treated in a nursing home. I think he was in England at the time. They clearly had a very good relationship. But a lot of people who've written about him since have questioned his sexuality. Why?
Well, there's no doubt that he was sexually attracted to men. And there was a conflict going on within him about that. Now, you can trace some of that in his own writings and the themes that he chooses and these relationships between men, same-sex relationships. They're not necessarily consummated, but you know there is an erotic charge there. And you also had contemporaries like Anthony Cronin, who wrote very openly about the ambivalence around all this and his attraction to men. And you know the marriage is difficult. I mean, there is a tenderness there. They got married in 1955, and it was a whirlwind. It was very quickly done, and there was a class difference as well because his wife Beatrice, who was an artist herself and the daughter of a well-known artist, she was very much middle class, grew up in Moorhampton Road. She was very quiet and she was attracted to his boisterousness and his dominance. He didn't always treat her very well. And of course, the alcohol and the addiction was a huge problem. He was adamant when she appealed to him to get help that he would have no truck with, as he put it, head shrinkers. But he was also diabetic, and that was diagnosed in 1956. And that combination of alcoholism and diabetes was mm-hmm. lethal.
And there was no helping him, was there?
No, and I mean, his favourite tipple was champagne mixed with sherry, you know. Ooh. So he really was on a dangerous path. That was very difficult for Beatrice, you know. And again, she acknowledged that, you know, there was the public being and the private mm-hmm. being. And, you know, at various stages they merged. And even though, you know, the daughter is born. His daughter, Blanid, is born just a few months before he died. And of course, you know, she grew up without her dad and he never really got to see her. But the drink took over and it also meant that he wasn't able to focus properly on his work. A lot of the stuff that's published in the late 50s, early 1960s, later in his career is lazy old rubbish, you know, it's taken from tape recordings or the work is unfinished. So there's a great lost potential there in relation to Behan. But we do have to be conscious, I suppose, of overly focusing on the broth of a boy, on the drunken Behan, even though that's a very important part of his reputation and indeed his infamy. There is a case to be made for focusing on what he did produce. And there's a range of work there that's very impressive. He's bilingual. He is experimental a lot of the time. There's clearly a great ability there. And he's a very important working class writer.
And the golden years, as you say, between 54 and 58 are the ones we should focus on. Dermot, thank you very much for coming in and we'll see you again soon. We'll take a break back after this.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.